The House Committee on Rules will come to order for Wednesday, May 8, 2013. I'm going to quickly open a work session on House Bill 231. Colleagues, we're just going to refer this to Ways and Means. So I would invite a motion, please, without recommendation.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3231A without recommendation as to passage to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Hicks moves House Bill 3231 without recommendation as to passage to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there a discussion? Any objection? Motion carries. Bill is referred. Close the work session, and I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3316. Since Representative Gorsuch is here, we'll get you up, and then after you're finished, we're going to close that and move to House Bill 3521. Go ahead.
All right. Good afternoon, Chair Garrett, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Chris Gorsuch, State Representative for House District 49, which includes the lovely cities of Troutdale, Wood Village, Fairview, Gresham, and a little tiny piece of Portland.
Yeah.
House Bill 3316A is a bill with the simple goal to increase or improve the accountability and responsiveness of the TriMet Board by increasing local control through a new appointment process. Under this legislation, the new board would have two appointees each from Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties, the Metro Board, and the City of Portland. The governor would retain one appointee, and as an aside, Multnomah County's appointees would have to reside outside the City of Portland so that we would avoid a lack of representation for the far eastern sections of the county. By giving appointments to local governments, we would increase TriMet's accountability to the elected officials it works with on a daily basis, increase the access that riders have to the bodies that appoint board members, and improve geographic balance. As board members make decisions on modes of transportation, service cuts, and fare increases, riders need to know that their concerns will be heard. It's much easier for them to lobby their city councilor, their metro board member, or county commissioner than it is to lobby the governor or a TriMet board member. Currently, all board members are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. In addition to geographic imbalance, currently half of the board members live in Portland. Board members do not provide what we would consider an adequate representation of the riders of the TriMet area. A 2012 Oregonian survey asked the board this question: how frequently do you ride TriMet? Only one member was a frequent rider. The remaining answers were very little, several times a month, occasionally, weekly or less, weekends, and about once a month. And so the question becomes, how can board members who do not use TriMet on a regular basis truly represent the needs of the riders of the system? Now, this bill is not just about this board or this governor. In fact, I have no axe to grind with this board or this governor. This bill is just about the board that we may have a decade from now, or governors who will be elected 10, 15, or 20 years from now. Having spoken to TriMet several times during the course of this bill, it's clear that various governors have different levels of interest in the board and the members that they appoint. While the interests of various governors may change, I can guarantee you that the local governments included in this bill will always have a vested interest in doing their due diligence when selecting board members. There are systematic long-term problems that have not been addressed properly by past and current TriMet boards. Decisions like the inordinate focus on light rail at the expense of more flexible bus lines, a problem with a previous diesel contract that lost TriMet millions of dollars, and the construction of light rail stations that are open and do not require the purchase of a ticket or a pass to access them, losing TriMet revenue and posing a security risk for riders. So I understand that this bill addresses a large problem and that TriMet has numerous issues that it must address. However, keeping the status quo of a governor-appointed board, the process that created boards that led TriMet into its current predicament, I believe to be a mistake. The people who live within the boundaries of TriMet deserve better, and I hear their concerns time and time again when I'm knocking on doors, attending town halls, or just out in my district. The time to address these concerns is now, and I believe HB 3316 provides a way to do this. So thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today, and I will give the the clerk my written notes as well. So thank you. Any questions?
Questions for Representative Corsi. Representative Kenner.
Yeah, I guess part of this, you've talked a lot about representation.
Yes.
I guess there are other issues too, financial and the future. You've given much, is that part of the thinking here too?
Well,
there seems to have not been a clear pathway to stay solvent, for example.
I started thinking about this several years ago when I was on the Troutdale City Council, which I started serving on in 2003. At that time, it was very obvious that East County cities were not getting a fairly good hearing from the TriMet Board. And so I have been focused solely on the governance side. I realize you're right, Representative Kenner. TriMet has labor issues. TriMet has budgetary issues, very serious issues.
Yeah.
And I am not bringing this forward because of siding with anybody in those issues. But I believe that
sides there.
What's that?
There's some sides if you want.
There, yeah, exactly. There are several sides, actually. But the whole belief is that if we were to make the board more democratic, that hopefully we would get better decisions and deal with those problems down the road in a better fashion.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Further questions? Representative Denbrough.
Thanks. Good to see you, Representative Gorsuch.
Same here.
So you're attacking the issue from the perspective of the appointing authority, who does
right.
the appointments. Have you also thought about looking at it in terms of who sits on the board, whether having, and actually, to be honest, I'm not sure exactly how it's done now. If there are,
it's an appointed by the governor.
Right, but yeah. I mean, are there designated slots to represent particular constituencies? You know, users.
As far as I know, there are designated districts right now, but I don't think that there's, at least as far as I remember, I don't think there's designated types of writers. But TriMet might be able to reply to that.
Because that might also be a way of looking at it.
Right, exactly.
To meet the concerns that you're raising.
Right.
Thank you.
Representative Holvey.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Gorsuch, interesting proposal when you get into governance, as always. You know,
yes.
Come from Lane County, where we also have a transit district as well. And ours is financed with through payroll tax that employers pay into the system. And is that the same with TriMet?
Yes. Payroll tax, and then there's also the fare box revenue. But the payroll tax is the bigger piece.
In the governance is, getting back to Representative Denbrough's question, I'm not sure, but it seems like there is a constituency, employer-based constituency that has to be considered in some of these board appointments. I'm not sure. I think in Lane County there is, but I was curious if...
I would suspect that comes into account when the governor makes an appointment. Yeah.
And follow up, Mr. Chair. And so I guess the question I have is where is that constituency, you know, based, you know, in the particular districts? Is it served by the districts the way they're aligned now, or does this new proposal take that into consideration of where that employer base is?
That's a good question. I do think that it would still come into account, and the governor would still have an appointing person. The problem that we have frequently seen is not so much that the business community isn't being served, but that individual riders have no real place to go in terms of their complaints. They can go to a board meeting, they can contact TriMet, but there's no requirement because they're not an elected body. And so as much as I'm sure that they have a very earnest desire to do the right thing, they may not always respond to the voters. And when you consider that we're all elected officials, Metro is an elected body, whether how you feel about Metro is positive or negative, city councilors, community or county commissioners. So it is, it's kind of interesting that a body that has so much influence over the day-to-day lives of citizens in the city of Portland and surrounding environs, that they have no direct voter accountability. That's what I was trying to get at. I hope I got your answer.
Yeah, I think so. I'm just tossing it back.
And yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another question. Are your cities in the TriMet district?
Yeah.
They are.
And yeah.
You know, it's Clackamas County. It's been interesting to see what's happened over time with cities withdrawing. And what's been the discussion about that among your cities?
The one thing I could tell you is that when I was on the council in Troutdale, we had been pretty unhappy with the 77 service, which comes out Halsey. And the mayor had a rather direct conversation with TriMet and talked about the potential of Troutdale withdrawing. And there was some improvement in service after that, but that's just an anecdotal piece. That's the only story that I can remember that related to that.
Thank you. Further questions? All right, thank you, Representative.
All right, thanks everybody. Have a good
day. Off to your next committee.
Thank you.
So now I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 3316. What we're going to do is we have several legislators here to testify on the next bill, 3523. We'll open it up to hear from them so they can get to their committees. Then we're going to close that. No, I'm sorry. Then we have two other people. So we'll go ahead and finish off that bill. And then we're going to go back to, we're going to go to 3521 with the Secretary of State. And we're going to do 3316 at the end. So thank you for your patience. We just have a lot to do today. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3523. And Representative Matthews, Representative Kenny Geyer, Representative Parrish, please.
And members of the committee, House Bill 3523 includes three bills we've previously heard in this committee regarding campaign finance and reporting of requirements. So they are require statements of independent expenditures to be filed with the Secretary of State, applies filing deadlines to additional statements of independent expenditures, requires campaign finance statement to be filed within 2 business days if contribution equaling or exceeding $1,000 is received during the 14-day period immediately preceding the election, adjusts other filing deadlines for campaign finance statements, requires candidate, political committee, or petition committee that makes expenditure that must be reported by candidate or committee as an in-kind contribution to provide written notice of expenditure to candidate or committee for whose benefit expenditure was made, requires candidate or committee to give notice not later than 48 hours after the original expenditure is made, and then we have it declares emergency as effective upon passage.
Who'd like to start?
Gentleman first.
The man in the middle.
Of course, I've been told. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Greg Matthews, State Representative, House District 50, Gresham. And I'll just say it right now, you're all thinking it. So, yes, I am a thorn between two roses. And and happy to be joined with the good representatives on this effort of 3523. And here to testify in favor of House Bill 3523. We are three together because we all three started this path as individuals, and we each had kind of our own plan towards campaign finance reform, and I believe it was, at the discretion perhaps of the chair to put these all into one bill. I'll testify on the portion of the bill that I had started with, which was originally House Bill 2419. And when we came to the committee initially, we had, I think, a great hearing, and I thank you for your time, and again today. But the issue remains the same. House Bill 2419, I believe, is unchanged, although there is an amendment being talked about right now. One of the areas that we took into consideration and needs to be amended, if it isn't already, and I don't believe it's in the current bill, and that is the difference between a calendar day and business days. We heard pretty loud and clear in that we should probably differentiate between calendar days and business days, and it was pretty obvious that in order to, perhaps please some folks and get them to a point where they could at least be open to the argument, we would want to address that. And so we're open to that. The bill, other than that, the portion of 3523 that, again, deals with what I consider to be rapid reporting remains the same. And just as a refresher, It'll create the deadline of reporting contributions expenditures of 30 calendar days within 42 days of a primary general election, increases reporting deadlines for contributions received and expenditures made from 7 to 14 days. This next portion, you may hear from somebody testifying about the amounts and how we compute that. I want to say, I don't necessarily dispute that. When folks come forward that have to enact the legislation that we're going to pass, I'd like to hear how they can best do that to meet the intended target. And that is, within the last 14 days of primary or general election, any contribution greater than $1,000 must be reported within 2 business days. There is perhaps talk that might come forward about making that language kind of reflect an aggregate total, so not just a $1,000 check and anything over that, but if you were to collect 4 $350 checks, I don't know what that's, again, don't know what the amendment's going to look like, and it's up to this committee if they want to entertain that or not. I'm open to the discussion because it comes from somebody I respect greatly in the industry, but again, that wasn't something that we had done initially. This was always about and has been about reporting large contributions in basically a rapid setting. Any $1,000 or greater contribution received prior to the 2-week deadline must be reported no later than the 12th day before the election. And then the Secretary of State may, by rule, establish periods for contributions during special elections that would follow these same guidelines. And that was really what we were after. And again, I think we've all talked about, you know, how much money there is out there in the campaign cycle. I think the public has spoken pretty loud and clear. They would like to see some reform. I would like to see some reform, and so that's why I'm here to tell you that proud to be with 2 colleagues on House Bill 3523. I appreciate the fact you took 2419, rolled it into the bill, and I hope that we can take steps forward this session. I think we have a great chance to do so in a bipartisan fashion and make some gains. And that's why I say that I'm open to suggestions from the industry that has to enact this legislation. I think you'll hear from someone from CNE Systems today, and look forward to hearing what Kevin has to say, because, again, respect him greatly. We have volunteer treasurers that we're very concerned about. I'm not interested in trying to protect the right to, you know, the jobs themselves. I want to make sure that our volunteers that are out there as volunteer treasurer can continue to operate in their capacity as well. So with that, I'll let you hear from my colleagues, but on my portion, 2419, it remains unchanged. I remain in favor, and overall in favor of rolling this into one great effort from this legislative body on House Bill 3523. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And, you know, since you three are speaking to different parts of the bill, maybe we just take questions as we go. If there are any questions for Representative Matthews on this part of the bill, we could take them now, or we can wait. I don't see any, so.
Thank you.
Representative Berger.
Yes, I was the one that raised the volunteer treasurer and the 24-hour mm-hmm. thing, and I'm furiously looking through this new bill to see whether that was addressed or not.
It will be, Representative. Okay. Mr. Chair and Representative Berger, the goal is to have that addressed. I believe it may be being drafted right now.
Okay, that's
but the goal is to take it from, as it was, calendar days and change that calendar days to business days.
That's all I needed.
Thank you.
Staff has a comment on that.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have spoken to the drafter. We have noticed that there is just a drafting mistake in the draft. It is supposed to be 2 business days. And so it reflects that in the summary. There was inconsistency in the drafting. We are already drafting an amendment to fix that, because that is the intent, is for 2 business days to address concerns raised by the committee originally.
Thank you.
Chronologically, yours goes first in the bill.
Let's not have this
started off with me earlier today, so I'll take the prerogative now. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Alyssa Kenny-Guyer. I represent House District 46, which is parts of Northeast and Southeast Portland. And my portion of the bill was originally House Bill 2018, having to do with independent expenditures. As you know, this is a growing force in politics around the country. Because Oregon doesn't have contribution limits, they are less prevalent here, but nonetheless, they still exist. House Bill 3523 contains a meaningful fix that will shed more sunlight on our elections by giving Oregonians faster access to see all the money being spent in our elections. OreStar is the go-to place for Oregonians to understand the money behind our elections. But while every candidate and issue committee can file contributions easily online with Oregon's trailblazing OreStar system, independent expenditure groups still file via paper form. The IEs reported, total IEs reported by committees in 2012 was 1.6 million, but the IEs reported via paper form was nearly 500,000. This has to do with PACs that are either registered or unregistered, and Kevin Neely from CNE or our Secretary of State can explain this technicality more. But the point is that some go online and some remain offline. And so if you go online, you have this impression that you're seeing what all of the expenditures by IEs are, whereas that's not, in fact, the case when a lot of them are filed by paper. So in order to view these paper contributions, Oregonians have to navigate an obscure page on the Secretary of State site, separate from ORSTAR, and look through different scanned PDFs. They are not easily searchable and don't show up in our ORSTAR reports. It's also not clear when these expenditures need to be reported. After the first 750 minimum that triggers a report is hit, how soon should the report be filed, and what do contributions after that amount need to be reported, and if so, by when? So there's just a lot of lack of clarity that this bill aims to address. So thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Kenny Geyer?
I have questions on this section, but I'm kind of, are we?
Go ahead.
Okay. So the bill requires that they file an e-statement, that it be searchable. And somewhere in here I read where there's also has to be notification to the candidate. Is that?
That's a different.
In kind.
That's in kind.
That's the
not
portion that I think Representative Parrish is going to address.
Okay. Okay. But there's nothing in statute that says an independent expenditure has to be
filed online.
The candidate needs to be notified?
No.
I think so. I'm happy to have those who have the technicalities answer more about how independent expenditures are.
Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, I think that's the point of an independent expenditure, isn't it?
Yeah.
That it's independent from the candidate?
That's right.
That's right.
So the candidate would never even know that it happened?
That's certainly possible.
They could be informed of it after the fact and have it still be considered independent, but they don't have to be. Representative Parrish.
Thank you. For the record, Representative Parrish, Julie Parrish from House District 37. To answer Representative Berger's question, the independent expenditure piece, as I understand it, is it's something that has been done for a candidate or for a cause, but outside of their knowledge, without their consent, and they don't have a control in the content. So this is somebody who takes out a TV ad or what have you, and it was done outside of the authority of the campaign and whoever's managing an issue or candidate. And that's why it's an independent expenditure, not an in-kind. And in-kind is, you know, which is my portion of the bill, is that you know something is coming and being done on your behalf, and you're given a statement. And currently the way the law is that if I was to do an in-kind from my political action committee to Representative Matthews' political action committee, I could make that happen, write that check, but I don't have to inform him under the law in any given amount of time. And so what sometimes happens is that transaction has been conducted on behalf of a candidate. It's going to be an in-kind statement that will come at some point to their political action committee. And so I would record that in my political action committee within the guidelines as described by the Secretary of State and the rules we all follow for campaign reporting. But the other PAC, the receiving PAC, does not have to report that in any given time at all. And so I could sit on a receipt potentially for quite some time, even into after the campaign, and we saw that in 2012. And then, long after the work's been done, then hand the receipt over to Representative Matthews, treasurer, where that person would then enter that in, but long after the fact. And so this looks to tighten that up, because if I'm making that transaction happen and I record that into my PAC in the time frame stated, one, we know that transaction's been transacted, and so the ability to email a statement that says we've transacted this on your behalf is not very difficult to do. So we're asking for a 48-hour, once it's been recorded in my PAC following the campaign guidelines, then it would be recorded in the other person, or they'd have notification, and then they'd have the time frame. So if you're in the 7-day reporting or if you're in the 30-day reporting,
okay,
right, then Representative Matthews' PAC would have the 30 days after I give him the notice. But what's not happening right now is people aren't giving the notice in a timely fashion, and so you don't actually ever get a chance to see who that
flyer could come or a TV ad could come, and you don't know who's paid for it, and you don't know where the money's come from because it's not transparent in OrStar. So that has happened, and I've watched that happen. The other piece of this is when you file a campaign transaction that's been conducted out of state and you're in OrStar, currently it's highlighted with kind of a pink bar that says it's an out-of-state transaction. What this bill would also do, my portion of the bill, and truthfully my brain's mush this afternoon, and I don't remember which bill number mine was, but the fact of it is that my bill had asked, and in this language of this 3523, is that if I conducted that transaction on behalf of Representative Matthews, and I make the denotion in my pack, it would have a different color highlight that would differentiate that transaction out of my pack was for somebody else. So right now what happens is you actually have to go in and open up somebody's pack and click through and read through the notes, and the notes aren't searchable. So unless you really want to go dig, you don't know who's paying for what for whom. And so the colored highlight bar immediately would show somebody who wants to look through OrStar that something's been conducted on behalf of somebody else. And then that reporting piece of, now that it's in my pack and it's been recorded, I need to let the other political action committee know. And then they have the actual reporting time, wherever they are on the reporting calendar, the you know, 7 days, 30 days, what have you.
Follow up.
So the different color chartreuse or whatever would denote an in-kind to another pack.
Yes.
Talk about the expense of that. I'm sure someone will bring that. I don't know if it is.
Shouldn't be too much. I mean, we're doing it. I have to defer to the Secretary of State for what that could cost from a technology perspective, but we do it for the out-of-state, and there's a trigger there.
Yeah.
Imagine tech, from a tech perspective, not super difficult to make that for somebody who's checking the box where this is an in-kind.
Any further questions? All right. Colleagues? Yes, Representative Matthews.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I do believe that the cost of chartreuse will be less because the pigments are different. But but I want to say, you know, we've had great success working with the Attorney General's office and also the Secretary of State's office, and I'd be remiss if I didn't say thanks to those agencies and those directors for doing such a great job. But beyond that, you know, we had a bill that was House Bill 2420 that dealt with some disclosure statements and did some of the things to try to bring folks outside from the shadows, and that bill's not wrapped up in a 3523, and understandably so. It didn't pass the test of an AG ruling that was fairly old, and now we have a very new one. I'm not happy with it, but certainly have a new one, and I respect it greatly. And so my ultimate goal, I would love to get at some of the folks out there that are running smear campaigns on one another with absolutely no skin in the game and no fingerprints on the document. We can't change that. It seems to be that that's the world we're going to live in, and that's unfortunate. In fact, I think it's one of the barriers why people don't want to run for political office anymore. But what we can do is a modest approach and incremental steps, and I think that 3523 represents that. So hope we can get this done, and I really appreciate, again, your time today. Thank you.
Well, thanks to all three of you for bringing your bills and for working with us to get a new vehicle that allows us to have a single bipartisan effort at this. So thanks again for your testimony. So we have two other witnesses on this bill. I'll call Kevin Neely and Noah Monger, please.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, thanks for having me again today. For the record, my name is Noah Monger, and I'm with the Bus Project. The Bus Project engages young people in democracy, and I'm here today to encourage you once again to support House Bill 3523 to increase the transparency in Oregon's elections. As we all know, the entry point for many young Oregonians on the route to civic participation is voting in their first elections. The Bus Project wants to make sure that these first experiences with our system are positive, that they build trust in our government, and instill the belief that each vote truly counts. One of the best ways we can do this is by making our elections as transparent as possible. As we know, Oregon is already fortunate to have a respectably transparent system of campaign finance, and this bill takes three meaningful steps to improve this already strong campaign finance regime. By increasing the transparency around independent expenditures, in-kind contributions, and large contributions in the final days of an election, this bill reduces loopholes that could potentially be used to game the system and hide money in the shadows. Notably, The bus supports the intent of this bill to provide 2 business day deadline for reporting of large contributions. We like that tweak and like that it gives extra leeway for volunteer and part-time treasurers, so we support the final language, hopefully. We feel this deadline is feasible, fair, and provides the public with the information it needs to make informed decisions. As Oregon has no effective legal limits on how much money can be spent in our political races, knowing where this money comes from and where it's going is all the more important. So that's why we support House Bill 3523 and encourage you to do the same. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Noah. Kevin.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Neely, and I'm the president of CNE Systems and a compliance officer and treasurer for, over 200 committees in the state. I'm not going to take a position on 3523, but I did want to just provide a little bit of information and a couple of suggestions that I think might make the bill a little bit better moving forward. Representative Matthews alluded earlier to the first one that I'll talk about. The bill, as it's currently structured, as you know, modifies the filing deadline for transactions that are $1,000 or greater. I would strongly recommend that the committee modifies that to be an aggregate amount of $1,000, so basically a donor-based $1,000 as opposed to a donation-based $1,000. That would track with the federal system that currently has 48-hour reporting, and in that system, if you have a donor that gives it $500 twice within that reporting period, that second contribution that pushes them to the $1,000 mark is reported. Obviously, that would eliminate the possibility that a clever firm like mine would break a $10,000 contribution into 11 contributions of whatever 10,000 divided by 11 is. So that clearly is a quick and easy way to abuse this this statute that I think on its face is a very laudable goal of making sure that those large donors are disclosed as quickly as possible. As I said, it also models it after the federal law that I think is a very effective statute federally, and I don't think it would be a significant change in the programming backside that the Secretary of State's office had to deal with. But again, important change in this. The second piece is something I've come to to various rules committees with over the years and always seemed to get amended, a non-controversial piece that I always amend into highly controversial bills. pleased to say I might be able to do that again today, but that is eliminating pledges. And I think it's particularly important if you narrow the timeline from 7 days to 48 business hours or 48 hours in general. Right now, pledges must be reported within 7 days if you're in the 7-day timeline or within 30 days if you're in the 30-day timeline. I can tell you that pledges are, in my view, the one really gray area that exists in the election law. There's no really clear definition of what a pledge is. A pledge to me might be something very different than a pledge to Representative Berger. And because of that, there's a huge, I'd say there's a huge difference between the way it's reported from treasurer to treasurer and candidate to candidate. Because our timelines are so short right now, it almost seems silly to report a pledge. You're going to know within 7 days, or you're going to know within 14 days, you're going to know within 48 hours of those big dollar amounts when push comes to shove now. And it's time to get that old artifice of our quarterly reporting out of the new reporting system. And really, I think, take away the last piece of gray that's left.
So the change you're proposing is just to eliminate reporting of pledges altogether?
Eliminate reporting of pledges altogether. Yeah, they would no longer be part of the process. And the last change that I'd suggest, and again, that's mostly because this looks to me to be the omnibus campaign finance bill. Another change I've supported and proposed over the years is to eliminate the Secretary of State's collection of bank account numbers. Right now, when you create a new committee, you're required not only to tell the Secretary of State which bank you're using, which I think you do need to do, but you're also required to provide the account number, which I think is a mistake on a whole bunch of levels. One, I'm not sure they want the responsibility of those numbers in their system. And two, it makes it difficult for volunteer treasurers to open committees. They go to the bank, and the bank wants to see their statement of organization, and they come to the Secretary of State's office and they want to see the bank account number. And so you have a little cart before the horse problem that is really, really problematic for those small committees that don't have professional treasurers like me. I can go to my bank and say, open an account, and they jump and open the account, and I don't have a problem, and I can report or give them the statement of organization later. So it's not a problem for big shops like mine. It's a huge problem for little shops, and it's time to take away that requirement. I suspect it was there initially so that if there was a problem, the Secretary of State's office had to audit that committee, they could easily access that bank information. I think as long as they know what bank the account is with, it's not going to add any extra onus to their job if, in fact, they get to the point where they have to go subpoena bank records in the course of an audit. I've talked to them about it over the years. I haven't talked to them about it this year, but that's been their feeling at least the last two sessions when I've stuck this amendment in really bad bills. Those are my comments on the bill. I'm happy to answer any technical questions about how we see this operating. I think that the panel you had before really did a very fine job of explaining the details of each one of the three provisions. And personally, I think, there's a lot of good policy in there.
Okay. Representative Berger.
Yeah, Kevin, thank you very much. As someone who deals with this, I totally agree with you on pledges. Totally agree with you. The only pledge that really counts for me as a candidate is the one that has a check with it. I want to clarify your testimony on the $1,000 issue. What you're saying is if $1,000 comes from a single donor during that 48-hour period, you're not saying the second half of the $1,000 that a month ago they sent you $500, now they're sending you $500 more, and it's over $1,000, so it's not reportable as in this 48-hour. I just want to make that clear that that's what you're talking about.
Chair Garrett, Representative Berger, I appreciate the question, and I'll be crystal clear about it because I clearly wasn't. Within the 14 days in which you're in the 48-hour reporting period, the aggregate should start on that 14th day before the election and continue until essentially the day before the election. I don't think it makes sense to have it go to the day of the election because all that's going to be reported after the election anyway. So it would aggregate from day 14 to day 1 or day 2 before the election. And so if you had someone who gave $500 on the 14th day and then $500 on the third day before the election, the second one on the third day would be reported. And then, of course, in Orstar, it would show the aggregate of those two transactions together. It already does that.
Right, exactly.
And if the $500 is contributed on day 15 and $500 then on day 3, it wouldn't trigger reporting, but under the bill as written, it wouldn't either.
That's correct.
Right, okay.
Yeah, well, the $500 would come in on the 14th day, so it would be reported the first $500 on day 15 before the election. Because you're in 14-day reporting, that first $500 would come in. It would come in and be reported on the day before the election. But you're right, that second one, it wouldn't be due for 14 days
right.
after the election.
Right. Okay. Any other questions?
That's right.
All right. I appreciate that. And I like these proposals. I'm going to ask that an amendment be prepared to do these things, and then if the Secretary of State's office, who is here, does have any comments from a technical point of view, we would ask that those be provided.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3523. Now we're going to go to our next bill. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3521. First witness will be the Secretary of State. And Ms. Seiler, can you catch us up on what this is?
Yes, members of the committee, House Bill 3521 defines qualified designated voter registration agency, directs qualified designated voter registration agencies to provide Secretary of State with age, residence, and citizenship data and digital signature of each person who meets qualifications set by Secretary by rule, directs Secretary to register to vote each non-registered person who is qualified to vote and to notify persons how to cancel registration and how to adopt or change political party affiliation. The measure increases maximum number of electors in a precinct from 5,000 to 10,000, establishes July 1, 2013 as date for determination of total number of registered electors in this state for purposes of maintaining status as minor party for 2014 general election. This measure is the -1 amendment for House Bill 2198. At that hearing, there were a number of questions and issues brought up by members and directed the Secretary of State to provide a FAQ to the members. It is available on OLIS. It was also sent out 2 days ago for you to review prior to the hearing.
Thank you. And colleagues, we're not going to move this bill today. I wanted to have an opportunity for the Secretary of State to come back and take additional questions, if there are any, about the new draft. So this is another opportunity to have a full discussion of the proposal. We'll be looking to move a final version at a future time. Madam Secretary.
Mr. Chair, committee members, good afternoon. I'm Kate Brown, currently serving as the Oregon Secretary of State. Thanks for the opportunity, and thanks for your time and energy here to testify today on House Bill 3521. As you are well aware, House Bill 3521 is an updated version of 2198. The relating clause in the original vehicle was too narrow to address some of the concerns this committee raised, as well as stakeholders. Two examples of that are issues relating to minor parties and precincts, the size of the precincts. As Oregon's chief elections officer, one of my highest responsibilities is to remove unnecessary barriers to voting for eligible voters. When technological advances make it possible to both increase voter participation and improve ballot security, I consider it my obligation to advocate for those changes. Specifically, as the committee administrator mentioned, House Bill 3521 proposes that qualified state agencies of right now, I only believe it would apply to DMV, Department of Motor Vehicles, collect four types of data: residency, citizenship, age, and digital signature, and share that information with the Secretary of State. The Elections Division would then process the information received from that particular agency and register eligible persons to vote. Each eligible person will be registered as an unaffiliated with a political party, and then the Secretary of State will send a notice to the person with a description of how to opt out of voter registration and also how to affiliate with a member of a party. Although a person can opt out at any time, before a person is added to the voter registration list, they will have at least 14 days in which to opt out. The purpose of voter registration is to identify people who are eligible to vote and enable that person or persons to receive a ballot. Any other purpose for voter registration, including demonstrating a certain level of responsibility or interest in voting, would be an unconstitutional purpose for registration. Registration was not designed to be a barrier to eligible voters casting ballots. Yet in Oregon, our Constitution requires voters to register at least 20 days before the election. Since 2008, and these are actually numbers we've been able to put our hands on since the last time I testified, nearly 40,000 eligible voters have tried to register to vote after the 20-day deadline. That's 40,000 voters in the last three election cycles. During the 2012 election cycle alone, 16,000 eligible voters signed up after the 20-day deadlines in both the primary and general elections. A number of questions have come up since I testified on the proposal at the last time. The chair requested a memo. I think you all have that in front of you, either in electronic form or paper form. I'd like to address a couple of the questions that have been raised. To address privacy concerns, the legislation proposes that before a person is mailed a ballot or added to the voter registration list, the person will receive notification of this voter registration process and will have at least 2 weeks in which to opt out of voter registration. We've also worked with Sybil Hebb of the Oregon Law Center to address additional concerns. I think she has submitted written testimony, which is in front of you. Persons with legal privacy needs, including confidential records as a result of stalking orders, domestic violence, or other law enforcement purposes, are currently protected in the DMV system. Protected information will not be transferred to the Secretary of State under this proposal and will remain confidential. And finally, only persons who will be 18 years of age by the date of the election will be registered to vote under this, under the language of this bill. Security measures. Before a single vote is counted, I think you all know we have highly trained election officials determine if the signature on the ballot secrecy envelope matches the electronic copy of the voter signature on file. This bill will maintain that high level of ballot security while ensuring that only citizens who are eligible to vote will receive a ballot in the mail. In terms of the minor parties, we've worked with minor parties to address their concerns. It's my understanding that, generally speaking, all the ones that we had contact with are in support of the proposed language in the bill. The proposal addresses their concerns with a phase-in provision that allows a minor party to use the number of registered voters as of July 1st, 2013, to maintain a status as a minor party for the 2014 general election. Finally, I think we all know that this proposal presents a bit of a paradigm shift. Some may argue that voting is a privilege and that citizens should have to demonstrate that they value their vote not just by actually casting a ballot, but by going through the registration process before they get their ballot. However, voting is a right and a power afforded every eligible citizen in this state. The purpose of registration is to identify eligible people, not to exclude them. As Oregon's chief elections officer, I think fundamentally our system should be weighed in favor of those who are eligible and who choose to participate. In a democracy, that's the way it ought to be. Thank you so much for your time and energy. Happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Thank you for the memorandum that was provided. This is the chance for questions. Representative Hicks.
Okay, Madam Secretary, I took away, or I think I heard, that only citizens who are eligible to vote will receive a ballot in the mail. And so, Senate Bill 833 has passed the driver's card provision that DMV will now be collecting information on issuing cards. And so persons who do not sort of provide documentation of citizenship, are they going to receive ballots?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, the folks that live in Oregon that apply for provisional driver's licenses have not provided proof of citizenship. Therefore, their data would not be forwarded on to the Secretary of State's office for voter registration purposes. So the short answer to your question is no.
Okay. And so you mean provisional driver's license, you mean the driver's cards, is there also known the same?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, yes.
Okay.
The folks who receive driver's licenses under the legislation, which is House Bill 822, I believe. 833. Yes.
Senate, yes. Okay,
so did
thank
I say,
you.
I'm sorry. It is Senate bill. That
822 is another infamous bill.
That too is, is somewhat radioactive.
Sorry.
But,
Freudian slip.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So, reportedly, the Marion County government estimates it'll cost something on a scale of $200,000 per year to implement this. And there is a constitutional amendment, Article 11, Section 15, that prohibits unfunded mandates and requires either a three-fifths vote or, I guess, the funds to reimburse. This sounds awfully much like a bill that would implicate Article 11, Section 15?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, that is not my understanding, since it is the job of Oregon's counties to handle elections. So it's my understanding that this is not an unfunded mandate.
Mm.
So let me address the issues of costs. A handful of counties have expressed concerns about the additional costs of, frankly, processing ballots and mailing out additional ballots. There's no question that there will be an additional cost because there will be additional voters added to the voter registration database. There will also be additional savings. Currently, counties must annually process 125,000 paper registration form filled out by eligible voters at the Department of Motor Vehicles. Each one of these must be hand-entered, costing staff time and increasing, frankly, the chance of human error. House Bill 3521 will replace those upward of 125,000 annual paper forms with seamless electronic registration at a fraction of the cost. It will save the counties the cost of hiring additional staff to deal with the surges of registration that occur as Election Day approaches. I think I mentioned in my earlier testimony, the Oregon Student Association registered over 50,000 students during the last election cycle. It's those surges that this bill will prevent. It will spread the cost of registration evenly throughout the year, increasing both predictability and saving staff costs.
Further questions? Representative Berger.
Thank you, Madam Secretary. You know, because we've discussed this, that I have an extreme issue here with the privacy of people who walk into the DMV because they want to interact with the DMV and suddenly find that they are now entered in a database that they gave no permission to be entered in. Is there any provision in this bill that would require DMV to say, by the way, by your action today, you are now entered as a registered voter in the state of Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, as I mentioned, that would only apply to those citizens that have the appropriate data, age, residency, digital signature, and citizenship information. We're talking with DMV about providing the appropriate signage. And as I mentioned, the bill provides at least 14 days for Oregonians to opt out should they choose to do that.
Follow-up. And during that 14 days, would they not be on the public database?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, that is correct.
I still have privacy concerns. Thank you.
Further questions? Okay. Thank you very much, Madam
Thank
Secretary.
Thank you very much.
Is Representative Fagan still here? Representative Fagan, do you want to speak? Okay, thank you. Then we will go to our first panel. Ruth Bendel and Sharon Cornish and Sandy Radu, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Ruth Bendel. I live at 10980 Southwest Muirwood Drive in Portland. I do have a lot of problems with the proposal in House Bill 3521. I've drawn to your attention a number of inefficiencies that have come to light. And, of course, the most recent one being the fact that in Multnomah County, 444 voter notification cards were erroneously sent to incorrect addresses. That threatens the voter identity vulnerability of the people whose voter identity cards were sent erroneously. A year ago, 1,000 voters in Multnomah County received ballots that were the wrong ballot style. We've got people, deceased people on the electoral rolls that are having votes cast for them, and nothing has been done about some of them, and anybody wants to see the worksheets from the elections office. I've got 9 with me. You're very welcome to see them. People that died in 1998, etc. You're also issuing voter notification cards to people regardless, with nothing on that voter notification card to indicate if a person has or hasn't given the requirements of identity proof. I look at what's being proposed in 3521, and I can see a vast spread of the confusion. 2 years ago, I was on grand jury, and I had 3 people on grand jury that had registered to vote, yes, and didn't realize that made them vulnerable to be called on grand jury. And I can see with this 14 days for opt-in and opt-out, government is government. Agencies have other priorities than what the elections agencies have. I can see that 14 days stretching out, things not happening the way they should, just as they don't happen the way they should at the elections agencies. And I just think that let's focus on the elections agencies cleaning up their electoral rolls. I've been a voter integrity chair for quite a few years, making sure that things are done in a timely fashion and that people realize what registering to vote really means. And I hope that the 21 days cut off before the election is maintained. After all, we did have the Rajneesh fiasco back in the 80s. That's why we got it. And relying on DMV records for verifying whether a person is truly eligible to vote wouldn't be applicable, really, until 2016. Because if you don't remember, some of us here do, there was the largest voter immigration fraud in Oregon history that was uncovered in 2003. And believe you me, we listened to the testimony of some of the coyotes, testimony that was given in contempt because of the ease of registering to vote and therefore getting that voter notification card and then not even doing the test because it was done elsewhere, the driving test, and then getting a driver's license, getting identity proof, and perhaps moving on somewhere outside of Oregon where they would take great notice of a driver's license issued in Oregon, or just a voter notification card. So please, let's clean up what's going on at the elections offices and the Secretary of State's office and keep it, get that going smoothly. And then if you want to allocate to one or two agencies, but just realize there's cost and there's certainly cost to the voter that didn't want to be registered in the first place. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ruth.
Good afternoon. My name is Sharon Cornish. I've been involved in elections forever. I'm a Methuselah. You have a letter in front of you signed by me, attached are some other information. One is from the Secretary of State of Kansas, and he gives you a letter about illegal aliens and how they get away with a lot of stuff in the U.S. He has also sent this to Congress begging our governor to do something about the elections. You'll find that interesting. My letter cover is what we've said. Yes, I've been involved in all of it. And we want a Secretary of State like Kansas clean stuff up. And if House Bill 3521 refers to other agencies, are they all governmental or are some of them NGOs, non-governmental organizations going to do our stuff on elections? It's happening all over. City of Hillsborough has a non-governmental organization advising them on what's pollution and what isn't. They pay $500 a year for this woman down in Oakland, California, to advise them on environmental issues. Is that where government's headed? To the private sector, non-governmental issues, because they don't want to handle their own stuff?
So they pass it on. I monitor drop sites. I hate it. We didn't vote for drop sites. We voted for vote by mail. How many people don't have a stamp? It's ridiculous. When I was watching the drop site at Brookwood location last, there were quite a few people who came up and said, this ballot isn't even in my neighborhood territory. And that's what Ruth is referring to as wrong ballots being sent out. It not only happened in Multnomah County, it happened in Washington County. Then they had to go back to headquarters on Murray Road and get a proper ballot. What is going on? This kind of stuff is happening all the time. And we don't go in and look for this. We pay attention at the drop sites. We pay attention to people being confused how to vote on their ballot because it doesn't relate to where they live. We want this stuff cleaned up. We don't want it passed on to somebody else or change the ID. If we're paying a Secretary of State, let's get it right from that department. Thank you.
Thank you. Sandy.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, my name is Sandy Radue from Beaverton, Oregon. I'm also the Oregon GOP Election Integrity Chair, and I'd like to testify in opposition to HB 3521. You all have a very lengthy written testimony from me. I'll refer you to that, but I would like to touch some of the high points. I urge a no vote on this bill. Voting is the most sacred right and privilege we have as Americans and Oregonians. Voter registration should be the responsibility of the citizen, not the responsibility of state agencies. That isn't what they are paid for, and that isn't what the taxpayers expect out of them. The bill requires the Secretary of State to register each qualified person who is not already registered to vote. I maintain some people do not wish to be registered, and this should always be a choice left to each individual. Some people have religious reasons, some security reasons, and so on. And although it has been addressed better than the previous bill, I don't think 14 days is enough time to allow someone, even if election office bureaucrat is on vacation for 2 weeks, it could delay this happening, and I don't think it's an effective way to fix things. Also, the bill allows the Secretary of State to determine the originating agencies. Currently, as she just said, it's to be DMV, but there's nothing in this bill prohibiting it to be other agencies, including, as ORS 247.208 specifies, agencies designated may include state, county, city, or district offices, federal and non-governmental offices. How can non-governmental offices be allowed to collect the data? How is the public notified that their data is being shared? How do people know when they walk into an agency, whether it's the DMV or anything else, that that data that they're sharing with that agency is going to another agency where it will eventually, if not opted out, if action isn't taken on the part of the prospective voter, that information will become part of the public record. If there's not a disclosure by that person, I don't see where the state has that right to share that information. Additionally, the electronic and computer security requirement for linking agencies is huge. I know it's in place for the DMV at this time, but for additional agencies, it needs to be NSA-level security. The liability risk is unprecedented for the state. When you think that the Providence Health Systems had to pay $20 million for one misplaced hard drive, how can we account for the security in several agencies throughout the state for voter data? In addition, it says data submitted with a digital copy of a person's signature under this section constitutes a completed registration card upon receipt to the Secretary of State. A digital signature being transmitted without the signer's permission, again, is a violation to me of trust. The bill also does not say whether or not that citizenship box of the assumed registration card is assumed checked in all cases, or whether that would be done by another issuing agency, not the DMV. would I have to check? If I want a hunting license, do I have to provide proof of citizenship, or are they, do they determine that themselves if that information is then submitted later to the Secretary of State? The bill does not state what happens if an inactive voter is re-registered. If someone has opted out, will they be re-opted in? What happens if an ineligible voter is registered? Are they subject to civil and criminal penalties? If a person is registered more than once, say under a maiden name and a married name. Also, in Section 9 of this bill, it provides for data being provided before, on, and after the date of this act, which means before this act was approved, that data could be shared, and I have a real issue with that. Anyway, the rest is in my testimony, and I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions for this panel? Okay, thank you, all three of you. Steve Druckenmiller, Kathy Eaton, and Mickey Eiselben. I might have gotten that wrong. I'm going to start asking people to be, we've got about 10 more folks on this and then one more bill, so if we can just try and be somewhat concise in our testimony, that would be appreciated.
Good afternoon, Chair Garrett, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. You have my written testimony, so I'm going to be brief, but I have a couple of points that I would like to make. Citizens who participate in elections give more legitimacy both to themselves and to the whole democratic process of voting. I think it's very important that people recognize that, even if they don't recognize it themselves, this gives them an opportunity to at least think about it. If they receive a registration card saying you are registered, do you want to stay registered? And they can choose to do that. But some of them may not, for a variety of reasons, registered, and this gives them an opportunity to do that. Secondly, it's good for Oregon to move into the 21st century when it comes to voter registration. There are many other countries across the world who have what is known as automated registration, particularly in countries that we don't even think about. And I cited to you previously Hungary and Bosnia-Herzegovina. But Iraq, in their first three elections in 2009, initiated an automatic voter registration for all of their citizens to participate in that process. And they found that, interestingly enough, it was cost-effective, it was secure, and it was accessible registration, things that we don't necessarily ascribe to a country such as Iraq. The League has been working on voter registration since its beginning, 93 years ago. We think it's very important for our democratic form of government that people participate by voting. It's a basic thing which they should do. And so we urge the committee to seriously consider it and to move it forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I will be brief because the Secretary of State stole all my material. And I don't know how she did that since I wrote mine about 11 to 1 o'clock in the morning. But
I would need your name for the record.
I'm sorry. I'm Steve Druckenmiller. I'm the Linn County Clerk. And I would like to also say that I am here representing only Linn County and the Linn County Clerk's Office and my opinion about this bill. And my opinion about this bill, it's the finest advance in Oregon elections since the day of vote by mail became permanent for all elections. There is no system that's perfect. And certainly, county clerks, and I am probably chief sinner amongst them, make mistakes. But with vote by mail, we can correct many of the mistakes. You heard about ballots being sent out incorrectly. Polling place elections, you have ballots handed out incorrectly many times. And you can't recover from that. But with vote by mail, we are able to recover many instances if something's been done wrong and correct it for the voter. The parts I'd like to highlight and emphasize that the Secretary of State already covered is, you know, we hear about voting being a privilege, and it is. And we all know that people paid a terrible price many times so that we had that privilege. But it's much more than a privilege. It is a fundamental right. And what that means is you can't limit that right unless there is a compelling reason. For example, we all learn in school about the, you have freedom of speech, but you don't shout fire in a theater. So there's a limitation on speech. What's the limitation on voting? It's, you have to be competent. And competency in voting includes five things, but you know, the things you obviously aware of are citizenship, age, residency. So the compelling interest or the compelling reason for having a voter registration system is to implement that compelling interest that justifies making sure that people, only competent people, are voting, which sounds like everybody in this room agrees to. So it's not a test. Voter registration itself is a tool. It is a process whereby we implement that compelling reason and bring not only accuracy to voting, but to prevent fraud. And that's the two major reasons that I know of for any registration system. It is not a proof that how good you are to register. You have that fundamental right. And what this bill does is it recognizes that. Now, if I could only take another moment to address the issue of cost, because that came up in a question. Linn County is not a well-to-do county. I don't know how many Oregon counties really are. But in my office, we've taken a 30% cut in personnel. And when I look at this bill, yes, there's going to be some costs involved. No doubt about it. But there are also the offsets that have been mentioned by the Secretary of State. And those are very important offsets. But regardless of some of those likely increased costs that we'd be dealing with, I don't know how in good conscience you can say, I'm going to keep built into this election system some sort of necessary inferiority or some sort of failure so that I can finance something. You cannot, if you have the ability, in my opinion, and as an elections administrator, and I love what I do, it is my life, you cannot, in my estimation, say we are going to finance this fundamental right for 75% of the people out there who are registered by keeping 25% not registered and unable to have the chance to do the fundamental right of voting. It doesn't make any sense. It's not when you have the ability and the technology to fix that problem. And lastly, if I could, there's been a lot of speculation as to why are people not registered to vote. We're going to be invading their privacy, that we're going to be doing all these things, and no doubt there will be some people who might feel that way. But I think Oregonians are pretty generous, kind people, and when they understand we're trying to reset this system to be inclusive of everyone that we can for their fundamental right, that they'll understand. But the Pew Foundation researched why do people not register. 19% say no time or just haven't done it. They seem to be people that maybe we'd be reaching with this. 17% said they recently moved and they hadn't. This bill would correct that. So we're up to about 36% now of people who would definitely benefit from this bill being implemented. Don't care about politics, that's another one, 14%. No confidence in government, 12%. Why don't we use this as an opportunity to try to build confidence in what we do and bring them into the system? For religious reasons, which was a very cited topic, the last time that this bill was discussed, the Pew Foundation found that that's 2% of the people. They don't register for religious reasons, which also matches laziness, 2%. So looking at these things, if we can fix the system so that more people are brought in, we have the ability to do it. Despite the reductions in my staff, I know we can do this. I know it. I absolutely know it. And I'm asking you to please give me the opportunity of proving that. And I thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mickey Allslavin, and I am a Purple Heart veteran who served in Iraq. I am here to testify in support of House Bill 3521, which would create a modernized automatic voter registration system here in Oregon. I believe in the democratic system, and I believe it is at its strongest when our citizens have a voice in the direction we take as a nation. I think Oregon can better at enfranchising our 700,000 eligible and unregistered voters. The system HB 3521 would create is far from new. It exists across the globe from Canada to Australia and even in Iraq. It is not often that the Middle East can inspire our democracy here in the United States. However, we helped Iraq build a democracy of their own. Iraqis instituted automatic voter registration similar to this bill. They did it to cut down on the bureaucracy and increase the efficiency in its fledgling government and to encourage more Iraqis to vote. They use every bit of information citizens offer to the government to keep voting records up to date. Automatic voter registration is an effective in creating a more accurate, inclusive voting system, and right now we have the opportunity to do it here. Looking back on my own experience in America as a voter, I can safely say I would have benefited from automatic voter registration. I was born in Minnesota, and that is where I cast my first ballot as a voter. My adventures in the military and in school had made me somewhat of a nomad, and every election cycle I was re-registering. Fortunately, Minnesota had same-day registration, which allowed me to register to vote on the day that I voted. And I believe that it is a very large part of why Minnesota has the highest voter turnout 12 out of the last 16 election cycles. I believe that Oregon could surpass Minnesota and many other states by passing House Bill 3521. Automatic voter registration would be the same as Election Day registration Minnesota enjoys, but it would work with Oregon's vote-by-mail system. Updating our outdated voter registration system to utilize the technology that we know works, shown by countries like Canada and Iraq, is the right thing to do for Oregonians and could serve as a model for other states. With over 700,000 citizens in Oregon eligible to vote, but who are not registered, we can see an incredible change in our future elections. Thank you for your time and the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony and thank you for your service. Are there any questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Next group will be Victoria Demchak, Barbara Dudley, and Emma Calloway, please.
Whoever'd like to go first, just state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair Garrett, Co-Chair Hicks, committee members. My name is Barbara Dudley. I'm with the Oregon Working Families Party. And I want to start by saying that as a minor party, the Working Families Party originally had concerns when we first saw this bill that the sudden and dramatic increase in the level of voter registration when this bill went into effect might create an insurmountable barrier for us as we maintain our minor party status based on a percentage of the total number of registered voters. We raised this with the Secretary of State, and she very promptly developed a very fair solution to the problem, which is in Section 8 of the bill. And as a result, we are fully supportive of HB 3521 and want to urge your support as well. Our support is based on the fact that although Oregon has a very respected vote-by-mail system, and relatively high voter turnout among registered voters. Fully a quarter of our eligible voters aren't registered, and that is not worthy of this great state. This bill is not about forcing people to vote. It's about allowing them to vote. It's about encouraging them to vote. It's about giving them the opportunity to be engaged in our democracy in what I believe is the most basic way possible. This body recently voted to give every school child in Oregon the opportunity to say the Pledge of Allegiance every morning in their classroom. Surely you believe that voting is as important an expression of patriotism as pledging allegiance to the flag, and we need to give every Oregon citizen that opportunity. Visibility, registration, turnout are greatest in years when we're voting for president, largely because national organizations put a lot of money into registering voters. But that money concentrates itself in urban areas, principally in the Portland metro area. You do not see a lot of people registering voters out on the streets of Grants Pass or Hermiston or Oregon City or Albany. Don't you want all of your constituents empowered to vote? Now, it's obvious that some people don't bother to register when they're offered the option at the DMV office. Why? They may be disinterested. They may be too cynical about politicians and politics in general. These views are formed by a media barrage focused largely on federal politics. And many among us would not disagree with the cynicism about the dysfunctionality of the United States Congress. But we should not add to that cynicism by not allowing an otherwise eligible voter to vote just because they missed a registration deadline that they probably were not aware of, or because they moved since the last election and didn't think to update their registration. How do we expect them to become engaged if they don't get a voter's pamphlet and a ballot introducing them to the candidates and the issues? I teach at Portland State, and what I can tell you about my students is that most of the poli-sci students and a good percentage of the econ students are registered to vote. But when you query a biology major, an engineering major, a business or accounting major, fewer and fewer of them are registered. Does that mean they're bad people or that they shouldn't vote? I don't think so. It means they're focused on other things and not on the candidates or the issues that so many of us in this building are focused on. They work hard, they go to school, they hold down jobs, and often they're raising children of their own. But when election time comes around, if they were registered, I guarantee you that the vast majority of them would vote, and they would vote intelligently. And you want them to vote. You want them to take an interest in your work on higher ed funding, on support for their STEM classes, on K-12 funding, on your efforts to find bipartisan solutions to difficult problems. You want them to be citizens in the fullest sense of the word. So I urge you to support 3521. Thank you.
Thank you. Emma?
Hello, everyone. Chair Garrett and members of the committee, my name is Emma Calloway. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Student Association, and I've come to testify on this bill previously, so I'm just echoing that support, but I have a couple stories to share about why we support this bill and the amendments. Quickly, as a business major in college, I can say that we definitely wanted to register to vote, and more folks were probably engaged and probably would have registered to vote under this bill, so that's great. Anecdotally, when I've been surveying students about this issue, students are moving about three times during their college education, especially on university campuses. And they're moving, especially in Corvallis and Eugene, from different house districts. They're moving in and out of house districts. And so we want them to stay registered and be up to date where their elected officials actually are representing them. We really like this bill. We think that House Bill 3521 really cleans up and hopefully lessens the workloads on elections offices over time. There are days during a voter registration period that overlap with the first couple weeks of classes where we register over 1,000 students in a day. And there are days, especially the last 2 days, where the Oregon Student Association with student governments, especially at the U of O, we registered 800 people to vote in the last 2 days of the voter reg period. And that is a whole lot of paperwork for Lane County elections and multiple house districts. And if anyone from Lane County elections is watching, thank you so much for all the paperwork. We really appreciate it. There are at least four House districts there, and this is, you know, duplicated at Oregon State and especially at PSU. So we believe that this bill really helps to keep students up to date, keeps them registered, helps people to register to vote for the first time in a way that's incredibly easy and accessible. And we hope that it means that student governments can defer their work around voter registration to get out the vote efforts and making sure that we're really working equally as hard in a nonpartisan way to making sure that every time a student receives that ballot that they're turning out and registering to vote, turning out to vote for the candidate of their choice and the issues that they care about. So thank you very much, and please support House Bill 3521.
Thank you very much. And here are our third panelists and take questions.
Hello, I'm Victoria. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. I am Victoria Demchek, and I am the policy coordinator with APANO, the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon. We are a statewide community organization that works to ensure that Asians and Pacific Islanders are fully engaged in the social, economic, and political issues that affect us. We are also in strong support of House Bill 3521. We believe that all of our communities deserve to be engaged in the civic process, and we believe that registering to vote should be seamless and cost-effective for them. Asians and Pacific Islanders have made generations of contributions to Oregon's economy, but we face real barriers to civic participation, resulting in one of the lowest rates of voter registration due to language access and a lack of experience with the democratic process as immigrant citizens. Our communities understand the importance of transparent, democratic government. They want to exercise their rights as citizens. And a growing number of immigrant and refugee families in our community have fled political violence and oppression and deeply understand that voting is a valuable right and privilege. As they become new American citizens and become involved in all aspects of American life, like starting small businesses and attending public schools, we do need good government policies like House Bill 3521 that reduce isolation and increase integration for our communities. However, this voter registration process is insufficient for our communities. Of the 200,000 APIs in Oregon, only 55% are registered, compared to 71% of the general population, though when registered, our communities vote at nearly the same rate. House Bill 3521 would reduce these barriers our communities face, make voter registration simple and understandable, and make sure that all of our eligible voters get a chance to vote. It would build a culture of civic engagement. It would ensure our eligible citizens to vote by removing those barriers and ensure that our communities continue to be engaged and become more engaged in the political decisions that affect us. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? We appreciate your testimony. Thank you. Next, we'll have Janice Deisinger and Greg Leo, please. We'll have two more after that, which finishes up this bill, and then we'll move to 3316.
Thank you, Chair Garrett, members of the Rules Committee. For the record, my name is Greg Leo. I'm here in my capacity as Executive Director of the Republican Party of Oregon. We are opposed to House Bill 3521. We feel this is a bill that is rife with consequence, all of which we don't know. We don't know what all the impacts this will be in the practical world that we live in. First of all, I think it's very important to listen to the clerks on this. And I'd like to call to your attention the letter from Deborah DeLong, the Malheur County Clerk, who points out the cost issues, but also the fact that there hasn't really been adequate discussion for all of the clerks in the state to be on board with this one solution. And I think that's the problem with this bill. This bill addresses the estimated 40,000 people who have not registered or are unable to vote in an election, last primary, because they didn't make the registration deadline. There are many other ways that we could approach that problem. First of all, there could be a very good, well-funded public information campaign that could bring people forward so they could exercise their responsibility to register the vote. That, I believe, would not have the impacts, both seeable and unforeseen, that this particular legislation would. As you probably remember, in the last primary election, the Oregon Republican Party opened our primary to statewide candidates, for candidates for Attorney General and Secretary of State. That caused the Secretary of State and the clerks to send postcards out to all non-affiliated voters in Oregon. One wonders what the unanticipated cost would be of House Bill 3521 were we to open, or the Democratic Party of Oregon, open its primary to all non-affiliated voters under this scenario. Again, another consequence, unanticipated, possibly very expensive at a time when we see that budgets are tight. So with a bill like this, in my opinion, this is the kind of bill that comes back in later sessions when legislators like yourself will be looking at the problems created, unanticipated problems created by bills like this, and think and say to themselves, and maybe even publicly, what were we thinking? Why didn't we anticipate the consequences of these bills before we passed them into law? So, Chair Garrett, I appreciate the fact you're not moving this bill today. I would hope you do not move it. This is a great candidate for a work session. If there is a, you know, kind of a work group that gets together and talks about this issue, I pledge that the Oregon Republican Party will be here to work with the Secretary of State, the clerks, and other interested parties to try to solve the problem of greater access. We are for greater access. We are for individuals exercising their rights to register and to participate in our electoral process. So with that, today I would urge that this bill does not move out of committee and pledge to you our commitment to work for a better solution, one that might anticipate some of the problems that this bill has.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Janice?
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Chair Garrett and Vice Chair Representative Hicks. My name is Janice Deisinger. I am the True the Vote state leader. I wanted to just highlight some of my testimony that I had for you, my written testimony. One that this bill eliminates personal choice to register. I'm concerned about that. I'd like to ask, where is the emergency that this bill has to be have the emergency clause on it so that the citizens cannot bring about a referendum if they are opposed to it? I do not see that it is fiscally responsible. As Greg said, there are many unknown problems and unknown liabilities. I think of the security breaches between the different computer systems and lining those up, and just all the number of people that will have access to them as being a great concern. This bill does not limit government, and I always like to see it limited. The people should instead exercise their own rights to vote instead of just having the government decide for them. It takes away from local control of the county clerks over the as the chief election officer for their county, and to clean up their voter rolls, and that is a concern for me too. This bill does not identify what constitutes citizenship documentation. Is it an attestation that I'm a citizen? For those, I mean, I see it for the DMV where they do collect the citizenship documents and they can know, but what other agencies check citizenship documentation? So is it equal between departments? Testimony, I showed you that according to the Census Bureau for 2011, there were 231,809 estimated non-citizens living in Oregon, and that was with a plus or minus error rate of 12,095, so that could be a possible 24,000 people that we don't know. We've got to have some kind of filter that would filter these people out in the areas that I spoke to earlier. When I was at True the Vote, Chris Korbach, one of the Secretaries of State talked to about earlier, was there, and he talked about, and I want to congratulate the Secretary for becoming part of the cross-state voter check, and I gave you a map of the different states that are participants in that, and the results, if the people were registered in more than one state, their numbers were cross-checked, and you'll see that Oregon had 115,000 people with a check in both columns, so that that's of concern. And you'll also notice that none of our neighbors are in the cross-state, so we don't know if there's people in these other states that live close by that could come in and become, and this bill does not address any of the concerns of people outside of our state registered to vote here. It does not address the dead people that are no longer with us. Their registration's been eliminated from the voter rolls. I also wanted to, I have the scholarly paper by the Heritage Heritage Foundation by Hans von Spaskowski. He's a Justice Department attorney and has dealt with all kinds of aspects of voter fraud. And he talks about quite a few problems with mandatory voter registration, and so that'll be there for you to examine at your leisure. He talked about the main problem with people not registering to vote was that they were not interested, they didn't like politics. That's the main barrier that we have to voting. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. Janice, any questions? All right. Thank you both. Appreciate your testimony. Our final pair is Blair Beauvier and Kate Titus, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Blair Beaubier. I'm here on behalf of the Pacific Green Party of Oregon. I have studied voting and election issues for several decades at this point. I taught political science at Western Oregon University, and I've worked with a number of nonprofit organizations, including the New America Foundation and the Center for Voting and Democracy. The United States has one of the lowest voter participation rates of any industrialized democracies in the world, and that's a huge problem. I think this is a great bill. I support it wholeheartedly. I think we need more and more voter participation, and anytime we move along the spectrum of trying to increase voter participation, there's going to be small costs associated with that and other problems. I imagine that when women were given the right to vote, resulted in a lot of increased paperwork and cost, but I don't think it's something we should be complaining about. In short, I think this is a great bill. It's great for Oregon. It's great for democracy, and we shouldn't be stopping with this. We should be looking at how we can get towards actual universal voter registration. It is a universal right. It's a human right. It's one that should be protected and advanced, and I don't think I need to say more. So thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Thank you, and thank you for your brevity. Kate, you have the last word.
Good afternoon. Thank you. For the record, my name is Kate Titus. I'm the Executive Director of Common Cause Oregon, which is a nonpartisan organization that works to safeguard and improve the democratic process. Common Cause supports this measure. We think it's just a common sense way to further modernize our voter registration system and has nonpartisan benefits that are widely shared. I'd just like to highlight three benefits that we think are particularly important, which are convenience, government efficiency, and supporting increased voting, the right to vote. In terms of convenience, I know for some people it may seem like it's not that hard to register to vote to begin with. Why change the status quo? But I would suggest that in this increasingly busy and modern world that we live in, the reality is that many people do find it burdensome to keep up with the all the minor bureaucratic matters of our lives. And as technology advances, we become accustomed to greater efficiency, greater convenience, and so unnecessary processes that are challenging become more so for us. And there's no reason to make the steps to voting any more burdensome than they need to be. I think especially in a country that prides itself on innovation and working stronger, we can work smarter as well, and as technology advances, we should just continue to advance with it. Government efficiency, I think this proposed modernization is not just more efficient for voters themselves, but also for our government, that by making fuller use of electronic technology and integrating our systems and information between government agencies, we save time, minimize human error, and keep government as efficient as possible, and that's a plus for all of us. And finally, I would just say I think it supports the right to vote and increased voting. Clearly, one of the benefits of this is that there will be an increase of registered voters who could participate in the system should they choose to. I think that's something that everyone here in this room can support. Common Cause favors policies that welcome and facilitate increase voting because we believe that public participation in this democratic process makes it a stronger process, makes for better decisions, and makes for more voter confidence in our decisions. So we support the bill. Thank you for considering it.
Thank you both for your testimony. Any questions? All right. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And thanks to everyone for your contributions to this discussion. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3521. And we will return and reopen House Bill 3316. And I'd like to call Neil McFarlane and Bruce Warner, please. Gentlemen, thank you for your patience through that last hearing. That went a little long, but we appreciate you waiting.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, thank you for your patience and the opportunity to testify. I'm Neil McFarlane. I'm general manager of TriMet. I'm here in opposition to the bill, but before I get into the specifics of the opposition, I really wanted to give you just a very brief overview of some of the issues that TriMet has been facing, and I think those issues are indeed one of the reasons that this bill is before you today. I recognize clearly that the last 4 years have been difficult for our riders and some of our constituents. We've had service cuts, we've had fare increases, layoffs, labor difficulties. And that has meant that we've had trouble responding to the needs of our various communities and constituencies within our service district. And candidly, one of the key variables in all of this have been certainly the Great Recession, but also an unsustainable health care benefit that needs to be reformed, that we need to get in line with our peers. But I also recognize that some of our constituents and partners and riders are not happy with all of the difficult choices that it's taken to deal with the challenges that the Great Recession has brought upon us. We have a very diverse constituency, as you know, 570 square miles. We're urban, we're rural, we have 25 cities. We are rich, we're poor, and everything in between. And our riders come from all walks of life. We have a lot of commuters, we have seniors, we have college and high school students that we provide great service to, people with disabilities. It's also important to note that over 50% of our revenue for our service comes from an employer-paid payroll tax. So the challenge in all of this is finding the right balance, particularly when resources are short. It's complex, it's ever-changing, and as you well know, very difficult decisions are required of the Board of Directors as we go through some of these challenging times. But this ability to deal with these challenges we face is why I, as general manager, about 2.5 years ago, began a multi-year effort to begin what we call service enhancement plans for areas around our region. It's a multi-year effort to focus on new and improved service in each of the major segments of our region. So we're looking at 5 sub-areas, the west side, the east side, southwest, southeast, north and central Portland, and we're putting the wrapper around the service enhancement plan for the west side now. And Representative Gorsuch will be, I think, encouraged to know that the east side plan is starting in July. So these plans, including the east side plan, focuses on access to jobs and educational opportunities. It will build on recent initiatives of local partners in the east side. In particular, that's the East Portland Action Plan, the East Metro Connections Plan, the East Portland in Motion Plan, and work led by our partners at Metro to look at things such as a high-capacity transit line, likely to be bus rapid transit as in Eugene, for the Powell Division Corridor, which serves much of East Portland. The goal of each of these relooks at the service plan is to see what the community's needs are, but also, very importantly, to help to connect better with the communities that we serve. And I think in the West Side example, we've done that very well. While it's very clear that TriMet struggled through the Great Recession, it's also, I think, important for you to note that we're not alone in that. Indeed, I can give you 3 examples. Pittsburgh, the city that's comparable in size to Portland, provides now 65 million rides a year. TriMet provides 102 million rides a year. In 2010, they cut 45 bus routes, 35% of their service. Fares increased from between $2.50 and $3.75 with a 75-cent surcharge on light rail. In Atlanta, very quickly, 30% bus service reduction, 14% rail service reduction. In King County, the agency that serves metropolitan Seattle, the King County Council approved a temporary two-year vehicle registration fee that bailed them out. But now that that temporary fee is expiring and the authority for it is expiring, they're facing a $75 million budget deficit, which could result in as much as a 17% service cut and a 25-cent increase in fares, fares that already run between $2.25 during off-peak periods to up to $3 during peak periods. So again, we're not alone, and there's no question that these have been difficult times to come to balance, and not just TriMet, but many other large transit systems. But what I would tell you is our board is suited to the task. Our board members are dedicated and skilled volunteers who provide immense value to TriMet and the community. That brings me to our particular points of opposition to House Bill 3316. First, like the legislature, TriMet's board is currently apportioned on population. So HB 3316 would move away from proportional representation toward local political appointments that are not representative of the population, but instead of political boundaries and jurisdictions. Second, appointed boards like that the TriMet has in the Port of Portland assure that agencies have representatives from a variety of professions with diverse experience and background. Appointed boards also assure that no single interest dominates the membership, assuring diversity and broad representation. Third, as I noted, the business community is the primary sponsor of TriMet and paying for the payroll tax and has long supported TriMet with the payment of that payroll tax, largely because of the appointed board. Over the years, many key business leaders have served on the board and they continue to today. And finally, TriMet's recent service cuts and fare increases are not due to the fare structure, but to the impacts of the recession and our legacy benefit issues. Changing how the board is appointed will do nothing to solve those problems. So I believe our current board is making progress. They have aimed at our cost structure at solving some of the problems that we have been subject to, and we are positioning ourselves well for the future. But we know that there is much work to be done. So with that, I thank you very much for the opportunity to come before you today and turn it over if the chair would to Bruce Warner, our board president.
Yes, please. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Garrett and members of the committee. Pleasure to be here. As Neil said, my name is Bruce Warner, and I am the president of the TriMet Board of Directors. And I might add for the record also the board member who does ride the buses and the light rail system on a regular basis. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today about House Bill 3316. Just very quickly as a bit of background, I am the former director of the Portland Development Commission and had the pleasure of serving with many of you as the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation or the director of land use and transportation for Washington County, and then also as the chief operating officer, regional environmental manager at Metro, our regional government. So I had a lot of hats on, and I've had, as a result of that, I've learned a lot about the Portland metropolitan region, its funding issues, its intersection between land use and transportation, and I'm proud to serve on the TriMet board because I believe a great public transit system is critical to the quality of our life and our economic opportunity. I would point out that I'm also very passionate, as are most of our other, in fact, all of our other board members, that we ensure transportation options for those who really do not have a choice. And I'm speaking specifically about those folks who are either elderly, those with disabilities, or those who live on limited incomes. But at the same time, we also want to make clear that we want to have a transit system that provides viable options for those who really do have a choice, and that we begin to address the needs of our major employers and small employers in a much better way. And what I will tell you is my colleagues are equally passionate about these issues, and they bring a number of skill sets, job experience, and diversity to the faces of TriMet and to our ability to address these issues. As a board, we have a strong commitment to community involvement and civic duty, and it is an honor to serve on TriMet board, on the TriNet board, and I want you to know that we do not take that honor or the responsibility lightly. I also wanted to let you know that Travis Stovall, who's a board member from Representative Gorsuch's district, has reached out to the representative in hopes that we can work together to address his concerns and the concerns of the community. And I want you to know that I am committed to improving this relationship because I believe this bill is a direct reflection on the board and our report card and in his, from his perspective. So we will work hard to do that. But it is important to understand, as Neil just stated, that the TriMet's current difficulties are largely due to the labor contract, which is locked in unsustainable health care benefits, as well as the 4 years that we've had of our recession, which has left TriMet and many other public agencies with slashed budgets and extremely difficult choices. So again, as Neil mentioned, changing TriMet's board appointment process is outlined in this bill. We do not believe really addresses the core problems that we have at TriMet. So again, thank you for the opportunity for allowing me to testify before you today on House Bill 3316, and Neil and I would be both pleased to answer any questions you might have. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Representative Hicks.
If for either member of our panel, if hypothetically one of Representative Gorsuch's constituents were to be dissatisfied with the job he was doing, their recourse is to vote against him. Or to and to encourage their fellow constituents to do the same thing. What recourse would a person, if a hypothetical person who is upset with your performance, have under the current system?
First of all, I believe that we're very responsive in terms of hearing those concerns, responding to them, and in but sometimes with great levels of detail and community outreach and involvement. My hope is that that can resolve many of the issues, and often it does. If indeed a person is still dissatisfied with the outcome, they certainly have the opportunity to come before the TriMet board, which holds public meetings and has a public forum every month, if not more. I would also note, for example, during certain other seasons of the year, like budget season, we just had a budget forum last night in North Portland, which board members were present for that. So I think there are many avenues to do that, including reaching out to the board very directly.
And Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Hicks, I guess what I would add to that is the board does have the responsibility to set the budget, the priorities and policies, and ultimately hire and fire the executive director of the agency. So that's one of the powers we have. If we believe the staff and the organization is not functioning properly, it's our job to take care of that. If the problem is with the board, then obviously the governor has the responsibility and the right to ask for us to be removed at any time.
Follow up.
Okay, so recognize it sounds like there are avenues. So the scrutiny then maybe isn't on whether there are avenues per se, but on the effectiveness of those avenues. Because frankly, in Representative Gorsuch, hypothetically, I mean, he's a TriMet constituent, and yet he has not met, it sounds like, with success, I presume, with those avenues, because now we're all sitting here. So something in my mind is not connecting. Can you please elaborate?
Mr. Chair and Vice Chair, first off, we can't address everybody's needs and concerns. I want to make that clear. With the financial resources we have, we can't address all those. But understanding those concerns and working with the representatives and our constituents and coming up with the solutions if we can is what we intend to do. I don't know all of the specific issues that Representative Gorsuch has in terms of service provision. Maybe Neil can elaborate on those a bit more. But I believe if the response or the requests are reasonable and we can and be done within the budgets that we have and the priorities we have, we usually try to accomplish and accommodate those requests. So I don't know that the issues are resolved or not. But as I said, what I want to do is do some further work on that with Representative Gorsuch, and I know Travis Stovall, who's the representative in that area, does understand and is working with the representative quite closely.
Obviously, one of the avenues of recourse is to introduce legislation that requires these gentlemen to sit in front of us and answer these questions. So, Representative Denbrough.
Yes, thanks, Mr. Chair, and thank you both of you for coming. So I have mixed feelings about this because, on the one hand, if I look at the current TriMet board, I'm not sure I've ever seen a more capable board, actually. I mean, just in terms of the backgrounds and the, you know, the qualifications of the people on the board. And yet, you know, at the same time, I do empathize with the sense that the board is somehow different from the mass of the ridership, right? And a perception that there's disengagement there. And I'm not sure what the answer to that is. I did ask the question of Representative Gorsuch earlier about, I wanted his sense of whether it would be beneficial for him to have different constituencies represented on the board, as it were. I'd like to hear your thoughts about that. The people who are on the board, I think, are, you know, very qualified, really professional people. Are they really representing the particular ridership groups or, you know, constituencies that are in the TriMet system, aside from the geography?
Let me start there. So, Mr. Chair and Representative Denbrough, thank you very much for that question. First off, I would say that our board is very engaged with the community, unlike boards that I've seen in the past, because I have worked with TriMet over the last 30 years, so I can tell you that this board is very active and engaged. And I would tell you from the budget process that I went through last year and talking to the hundreds of folks that were very interested in the organization, I can tell you that their voices were heard. Again, not necessarily were we able to agree with all of the comments were made and in fact had to make some hard decisions about fare increases and service cuts. But I would say that first off, we are engaged with the community. In terms of representing all of the interest groups that are out there, I don't think we can represent all those folks with a group of five members or seven members on a board. I don't know whether you could do it with the 11 or 12 that you have here, but I don't see those kind of criteria in the bill that would get to that. But I know that the governor's office is very interested in having a representative group on the TriMet board that does represent the region and its constituents, and I look forward to working with him. As we have one appointment right now, that's the board position that's open, and over the next few years we'll have some more. So I think there's some opportunities to make some changes, and if you have suggested changes, we'd love to hear those.
Can I follow up?
Sure.
How do you feel about the size of the board at this point? Do you find seven a good number? Would there be a benefit perhaps of adding a few members to the board? Would you think that would really limit your ability to be effective? And perhaps that could be a way of you know, adding other perspectives, as it were.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, and again, Representative Denbrough, that seven works very well. It's a nice number. It's an odd number, first off, which works very well, as you know. You start getting, the bigger you get, the harder it is to actually be engaged in all of the issues. And you do tend to get specific interests aligned with one individual on a larger board. So with a small board, everybody has to understand all of the issues. So there's pros and cons. So I wouldn't want to give you any estimation of the best number, but seven that we have works very, very well, and I'm pleased to work with them.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you both very much for your time and testimony. Colleagues, we have three people who want to speak to this, so I'm going to continue the hearing for a few more minutes. I know some folks may have to leave. That's fine. I'm just going to give the three who want to testify a chance to speak. So John Hummel, John Charles, and Janice Deisinger, please.
Vice Chair, member of the committee. I'm John Hummel. 2 minutes. I understand people have to leave. I'm the state and federal policy director for the Oregon Primary Care Association. OPCA is a nonprofit membership association of Oregon's 31 community health centers. We operate 201 health clinics throughout the state. Our health centers provide care on an annual basis to 330,000 Oregonians. We care for primarily uninsured and patients on Medicaid. Many of our patients rely on TriMet to travel to health centers, yet riders and rider advocates are underrepresented on the TriMet board. And in light of the current gubernatorial appointment process, riders and rider advocates have limited opportunities to successfully advocate for greater representation on the board. Community health centers were established by the Federal Public Health Safety Act. That law requires a majority of our nonprofit health centers to be governed by boards made up of patients. Majority of the board of our health centers have to be comprised of the patients we serve. There's certainly more effort and attention required on the front end to orient and equip low-income Oregonians and otherwise marginalized patients to successfully serve on the board than would be required to orient a doctor, a lawyer, or another professional. But our experience in our health centers is that that additional effort produces significantly better results on the back end. The operations of our health centers, the patient experiences in our health centers, and the health outcomes achieved by our health centers are all positively impacted by the involvement of patients on our boards. We are confident that enhanced participation of rider and rider advocates on TriMet's board would produce similar positive results. So please vote yes on House Bill 3316. Doing so will provide a meaningful voice to TriMet riders. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you all for sticking it out to the bitter end here. My name is John Charles, President of Cascade Policy Institute, a nonprofit policy research center. I've been a longtime TriMet rider. I've attended hundreds of TriMet board meetings over the last 30 years, and four of their most recent half-day planning retreats, I've also sat through all of them. I've heard all of these issues discussed many, many times, and I support this bill because I believe their governance model simply doesn't work. And this is not an indictment of the current board specifically or the current governor. This has been wrong for at least 20 years. And I'll briefly explain why. The first attachment, has the testimony been handed out?
No.
The first attachment in the testimony is a sheet from TriMet's outside audit, which indicates that they have more than $1.2 billion of unfunded actuarially accrued liabilities in their three different retiree trust funds. Now, this did not happen overnight. You know, when you wake up and say, gee, we're missing $1 billion from trust funds that we have a fiduciary responsibility to manage, that takes decades of mismanagement to lose $1 billion. Something's wrong there. That's the first sheet. And I suggest that you, it's produced by actuaries. They're about the least political people I know of. So I suggest you study the numbers carefully and wonder what happened to the management model. Second, TriMet's ratio of fringe benefits to wages, 156%, is the highest that I know of in the transit industry. That's the green sheet that's attached. Again, you don't get so upside down on that issue in one negotiation. You have to misnegotiate over a very long period of time to have such an absurd ratio of fringe benefits to wages. Third point, when the chair of the TriMet board mentioned repeatedly financial problems, well, TriMet came here twice in the last decade, 03 and 09. Twice you gave them an increase in the payroll tax rate. The second one hasn't been implemented yet, but in 03, that one was implemented in 05. And I show on the attached sheet, the yellow sheet, that since that went into effect, TriMet's total revenues, their all funds budget, has gone up 125%, and their service has dropped by 14%. It's a bureaucratic miracle. How does that happen? Okay, money is not the problem. In fact, to TriMet's credit, they admit in their most recent long-range forecast that their problem is, quote, not caused by TriMet's revenue base. Money is washing into that place. TriMet's general manager predicts that on its current path, TriMet will essentially cease to exist by 2025, 2027. That's, this particular sheet is one that he has produced and indicates in the long run, they will, if nothing changes, they will be basically exist to send out money to Wall Street bondholders first, retirees second, and a tiny amount of money left over to writers. Well, then they're admitting not only has their governance model failed, is failing, it will fail. So I've attached some numbers there to show that they're, what they're doing with all their light rail construction compared to bus rapid transit of any type, either the Eugene version or the much cheaper version down in Los Angeles, indicates that they are misallocating money on the capital side. And finally, for over 30 years, governors have either ignored TriMet or intervened for the wrong reason. The most notorious was 19 years ago, the summer of 1994, when Governor Roberts called down Lauren Weiss, the board chair, to her office and ousted him for daring to do his job, in which he was objecting strenuously to an entirely new contract that was going to ruin the agency. So for doing his job, he was ousted. The other six board members got the message, signed the contract, and for 19 years, what have they been doing? Entire generations of board members and management continuing to re-up the same contract. And here's what Lauren Weiss said in a letter to the editor in December of 1994, his final sentence, and I won't read the whole thing. If there's one predictable reason for transit to fail its mission, it is the burden of fixed costs, which this contract guarantees. Unfortunately, Mr. Weiss passed away over the weekend. He's yet to be vindicated, I guess, by people who got rid of him. But every single thing he predicted in 1994 came out correct. And what has the TriMet board or any governor in the last 19 years done? Nothing. Procrastination. More of the same. I don't think we can wait to be rescued here by the same model. It's not working. I do agree with the TriMet team that House Bill 3316, as currently written, would not do very much. It would do something. I think ultimately, if you really want to address this problem now or some other session, if you procrastinate some more, you have to make it easier for jurisdictions to leave TriMet, which right now is possible, but it's extremely difficult. And the jurisdictions that have left TriMet, Wilsonville, Sandy, Canby, Malawa, have shown that smaller is better in transit, that they can all do the job better, cheaper, and faster than TriMet. TriMet actually needs to shrink to save itself, and you can help them shrink by changing their enabling statute to allow jurisdictions to simply leave and let the district shrink and let them spin off. That might help the fundamental problems of the agency. Thank you.
Thanks, John. Janice.
Hi, I'm Janice Deisinger. Thank you, Chair Garrett and Vice Chair Representative Hicks. I am a citizen of the Tri-County region, and I just wanted to say that I support HB 3316. It brings this the control, or at least the discussion amongst the board members, to people who are more closely associated with the region and the people that will be responsible for the use and paying for it. So I would just encourage you to consider passing this bill. I think it's a good step. It is a tiny step, but at least it's a step in the right direction. And it doesn't address, as John Charles pointed out, it doesn't address the cost issues that are not funded, that are huge, in millions each week. So we need to come to, if you look through his paperwork there, it's pretty amazing the amount of money that's not and allocated. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. And there's a lot more that could be said on this, but it's already 12 minutes after, so I'm going to close the public hearing. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you.
Didn't occur to me there was a question.
Yes. Mr. Charles, are you familiar with the financing situation in Lane County for Lane Transit District?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I'm only generally familiar with it. I look at their financials once in a while.
Well, I'm struck by the reality that, I mean, I've looked at the way in which the TriMet Board is appointed. I'm very familiar with Lane Transit District. It's a setup, as far as I can tell, exactly the same way in terms of the way the appointment process works. My sense of it, at least, is that the results we're seeing are very different. my suspicion is it doesn't have to do with the way the board is constituted. What's your thought about that? What's your response to that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, I take your point. It's sort of idiosyncratic. I don't understand it totally. It's possible with a different governors over time who might have taken more of an interest in TriMet affairs, it might have worked out differently, but it hasn't.
And, yes, follow up.
Yeah, thank you. Just very, very quickly, I understand, I think, the general tenor of the testimony that we've heard, and of course this is not the first time I've heard about the issues that face TriMet, but I would suggest, Mr. Chair, that the solution that we're looking at, that this bill proposes, ain't the fix. Something else is. Thank you.
Thank you. I think that's probably correct. Yes, Representative Kenmer.
Just tend to second to Representative Barnhart's analysis.
Representative Hicks.
Though on the subject of Lane, I mean, all I know about it is that I drive through it twice a week, and I see these signs that say no build, no elected board, no citizen voice. And so perhaps Lane is in better, I don't know, they must sound like they're in better shape, but it sounds like the level of frustration is still, there's some level of frustration because putting up signs. And it's due to the same source. It's the constitution of the board, or the, not the constitution, but the nature of the board. So I just know I see those signs. I don't know what they're all about. But no. I'm sensing frustration with the way the board comes into being as being a source of that.
Mr. Chair, let me just respond to that very briefly, if I may.
Sure.
By suggesting that we're talking here about the finances, the issue you're raising has to do with the way the build-out of the MX system is being planned. There is a small group of business people in the western part of Eugene who strongly object to the plan. Most of the rest of the people in Eugene, I think, are supportive. It is a very, very different, as the witnesses pointed out, it's a very different plan in terms of cost and operation and efficacy from the plan that's used in Portland for the trial. Now, and I'm not an expert in any of this stuff, but the issues that he's raising here have to do with the finances. And I think they're very, very different kinds of problems.
Thank you, everyone, for sticking through to 5:15. Close the public hearing, and our committee is adjourned.